This week, we welcome Nick Galbraith, co-founder and chief technology officer at Signal Sciences, to discuss the intersection of development and security. In the leadership and communication segment, how Boeing should have responded to the 737 MAX safety crisis, digital transformation is not about technology, Gartner's top 10 security projects for 2019, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Effectively securing your organization and its reputation requires a smarter approach. To maximize efficiency and minimize risk, security experts turn to LogRhythm, the only leading solution built solely for security teams by a security team committed to your success. With next-gen SIEM, user and entity behavior analytics, network traffic and behavior analysis, security automation and orchestration, and compliance, LogRhythm provides security made smarter. How do you use the information from this show to address issues that executives actually care about? TrustedSec is a global information security consulting firm built on cutting-edge attack simulation research that extends those insights to advisory services including governance, risk, and compliance, PCI, virtual CISO, and MITRE attack framework assessments. TrustedSec helps you translate the types of zeros and ones that you care about to the types of zeros and ones that executives care about. Go to trustedsec.com/securityweekly. Learn how TrustedSec can become an extension of your team.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 121, recorded March 18th, 2019. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado, joined by my co-host, Paul Asadorian, in G-Unit Studio in Rhode Island.
Hey, Paul. Thanks, Matt. Good to be here.
I see you have your green on from yesterday.
I do. I was going to wear this yesterday, but it was in the wash, so I decided to wear it today.
Okay, good.
Still in the St. Patrick's Day spirit.
Right, sure. Why not? Register for our upcoming webcast with LogRhythm and Recorded Future by going to securityweekly.com/webcast. If you have missed any of our previously recorded webcasts, you can find them at securityweekly.com/on-demand. Also, join us April 1st to 3rd at Disney's Contemporary Resort for InfoSec World 2019. Visit infosecworld.misty.com/security-weekly and use the registration code OS19-SecWeek for 15% off the main conference or World Pass. I will be presenting at the DevSecOps Summit on Saturday. We will also be recording at InfoSec World 2019. So if you're interested in booking an interview or briefing with us, please visit securityweekly.com/conference-request. All right, let's get to our interview. Nick Galbraith is the co-founder and CTO at Signal Sciences. Prior to Signal Sciences, Nick scaled engineering infrastructure and teams at a number of online advertising, e-commerce, and social media companies, including IPenWeb, Etsy, Right Media, YouPromise, Friendster, and Open Market. The author of Cryptography for Internet and Database Applications, he's been awarded a number of patents in social networking and has published extensively on new security approaches in continuous development and DevOps environments. Nick, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Glad to be here, guys. I'm in sunny Los Angeles today.
Sweet. Nick, I have to ask, what was it like at Friendster? Because I remember that social network back in the day. I'm just curious now.
No, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing like no matter what I do, we're in a VC meeting, we're fundraising. They're like, okay, that's great. But what happened at Friendster?
Yeah. No, I didn't ask what happened. I asked what it was like.
Well, let me tell you, it was actually a really fantastic experience for a number of reasons. Friendster was sort of the first company that really caught some air after sort of the dot-com crash. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first companies that really hit international scale. And as you probably remember, it was not well equipped to deal with it at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I got gotcha.
At the time, like we had VCs, like the user growth is amazing. And then, you know, like a year later, they're like, what happens? Like, well, most of the growth is in the Philippines. And they didn't never ask those questions.
Right.
Like if you have international consumer based company, it's just assumed like, okay, where is it? Where are you getting traction? Mm-hmm. But at the time, like no one was actually thinking that way, or even the consequences of what does a international social media network look like. That's no one had any idea. And everyone was sort of caught off guard at the scale and growth.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know, back around that time, if we relate that to security, right? We obviously have a lot of different security vendors in a lot of different categories. And when you break it down in those subcategories, there's usually like a few players in each category that are continuing growth and growing as companies. If I go back and I look at social media, right? Like what was the one that there were some that competed with Twitter, there were some that competed with Facebook. And like pretty much when you emerge from that social media, those social media giants are the only ones left, right? Google just shut down Google Plus. Yeah. It seems like they're like there's a category king in social media in a certain vertical and that's it. Like there's no one else, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember that.
Actually, I was going to bust on you for like, you know, Friendster, really. But you know what? It's very apropos because who was my coworker at the time? John Alspaugh, who is well known for, you know, sort of pioneering a lot of DevOps work in operations.
Yeah.
And I worked with him again at Etsy, actually, years later. So it was kind of a nice reunion, which is where sort of a lot of the sort of techniques and sort of lessons learned from really protecting, you know, massive e-commerce sites really came to focus on how I view security.
Well, and that's the important thing. When we hire here at Security Weekly, and we encourage others when you hire, like you want to hire people that have tried stuff and it didn't work out, right? Because the lessons learned that they bring to the new organization to me is far more valuable, right?
That's why Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley. It's not necessarily the winners, it's the amount of failures that happen, which people learn so much so fast.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The cycle is really tough to beat. So yeah, when, you know, me and my co-founders were at Etsy and we basically had in some ways like Friendster, it was a very rabid community, wildly growing, but had sort of severe operational problems, but was also making money.
Right. So
in some ways it was kind of like worst case scenario for a security, you know, environment.
Yeah. Well, and there was the commerce component with Etsy really made security issues much greater than even a social network, right?
Absolutely. And just for people who aren't familiar, Etsy is like an online marketplace where both buyers and sellers don't know each other. So it creates incredible opportunities for fraud and security problems. The interesting stories I can tell you about, like, you name it, every type of scam imaginable will be attempted that way.
Yes. It was amazing to watch eBay and PayPal deal with all of that, right? Which is kind of similar. Yeah. They're buying and selling things without knowing who the buyers and sellers are.
Very similar, yeah.
But one of the things Etsy, I think, was really good at was this forefront of DevOps and security in the intersection, which is kind of what we wanted to talk about a little bit in this interview.
Sure.
Is because we see this example over and over. Netflix was another one, obviously. Mm-hmm. They were on the forefront of really starting to understand kind of how development and security were going to come together. And we know the challenges, right? I've talked about this for years. I know you guys have over at Signal Sciences, is how does security really work closely with the development teams under this new model? And I want to dig into some details because I think there's a lot of lessons learned over the work you did at Etsy and the things you guys have subsequently done at Signal Sciences.
Yeah, I mean, Signal Sciences was basically take the lessons learned from Etsy and turn and productize it, because none of us actually wanted to go to another company and redo the exact same thing all over again. But you know, the integration of security and engineering was it wasn't because we were super geniuses, or maybe we are, but the real issue was we had to do it because there was no other way of securing a site with that much exposure and that much change velocity that was happening at the time, as well as the operational issues when we first started and whatnot. So we really just had to try something new just in order to save the company, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so let's talk about that a little bit. So what was the approach of how security had to integrate itself in, because I think this is an area a lot of people struggle with. Traditionally, sure, we've looked at security in a waterfall approach, kind of at the end of the line, a kind of, okay, security, do your thing before we release this code. And that happened periodically. It wasn't anywhere near the speed we're at today with DevOps, right? I mean, in these environments, multiple times a day, releases of code are realistic, and you can't be at the end of that pipeline anymore. So
right,
how does that, you know, how do we start to tackle these issues and move security and integrate it into that whole DevOps process?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a tough answer to say in a short period of time, but there's basically, you have to sort of understand the risk of the different code deployments. So, you know, front-end engineers working on CSS is something you typically, not always, but typically don't have to worry about. And so what you really want to do is sort of instrument your process so you actually know what's high risk and what's not high risk, and let people doing low risk stuff do their low risk stuff because you have much more important stuff to do. So how do you go about doing that? Sometimes it's flagging files. So if they change, you get alerted. There's certainly a large portion on static analysis, which has to run at every check-in. You can't do it once a week or even once a day. It has to run every check-in. So that is likely to change a lot of the engineering processes, because a lot of the scanners, you know, they're slow or lots of false positives. So you really have to spend some time being on top of that. And then sort of doing deltas from like a known good or you know, what's changed from yesterday to get a handle on what actually is happening.
Right. And so obviously that static analysis is part of the build check-in and the build process.
Absolutely.
It's super critical.
Because that said, nothing, you know, nothing's perfect, right? And so the other thing we did is, you know, instead of shift left, which we certainly did a lot of stuff, the faster you can tell an engineer something's wrong, security, operational, QA, whatever it is, the sooner you can tell the engineer, the better. So absolutely, shift left, get that information to developers. But at the same time, especially when we were at Etsy, but I think not dissimilar to most sites, there's a whole bunch of legacy stuff. There's a whole bunch of like unknowns. So the other thing is instrumenting your application so you can see attacks and problems in real time. That helps you sort of prioritize, you know, what to look at, where to go, and how to do things. So in some ways it's like, by all means, push shift left as hard as you can. But at the end of the day, once your code's in production, you need something telling you what's going on as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a gap we've had traditionally. You know, the developers maybe not putting the right data logging information that we need. Then we've seen security try to do it kind of from outside the application, where you've tried to add capabilities to kind of look at that runtime. I've seen shifts back to trying to embed some of that instrumentation into the app, but that also creates some interesting challenges, I think, for the developers, right? If it requires a new library or a set of APIs or SDKs to be integrated, you know, does that slow down development? So I'm curious, what are some of the effective ways to really get that instrumentation, but also not really impacting development? Because I think that's one of the challenges or kind of one of the pushbacks from the development teams a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. So every CISO, and I'm sure many of your audience members, are sort of done with point solutions. They've bought solutions for Java. They've bought a solution for .NET. Maybe they have something for PHP. Every time there's a new sort of element in the stack, it's like a new tooling, a new tool set. And that can get really expensive, not just in the upfront cost, but the time and training and management and things like that. So it definitely is a challenge for like larger organizations, which basically have one of everything, right? Like the larger the company, the more diverse the ecosystem is. So it is a challenge in instrumenting things, you know, in a way that's scalable. So, you know, most companies have some crown jewels that it's a little easier to get some argument, you know, win some fights over, you know, what gets instrumented or not. But then you have this huge backlog of legacy stuff that's challenging to instrument as well.
Yeah, and Nick, I think you really hit on a great point there, and I think it kind of opens up people's perspectives, because like here at Security Weekly, for example, right, we've got one software project, right, that is critical to running the business, but when you start moving into larger and larger enterprises, right now they've got multiple dev teams working on multiple projects, and they adopt different technologies and methodologies. And so you may have the greatest thing since sliced bread to improve your SDLC, but ultimately it's going to be running somewhere, and they may not have followed that same SDLC and used the same tools, right? If I'm hearing your thoughts correctly.
Oh, absolutely. And then your legacy applications, like the scope and scale of them is fairly enormous, not just external, but internal as well. And, you know, I remember a long time ago, I was in New York, I attended an OWASP meeting, and a CISO from one of the investment banks came on stage, and he's just like, oh yeah, the New York office has like 5,000 employees and we have 13,000 applications. Just like, good luck with that, man. Like that's going to be a really challenging job for you. So, you know, part of this is exactly what sort of Signal Sciences does, is to sort of allow you to plug into lots of different infrastructure and get that telemetry. So that's basically why we started the company, because getting visibility in your infrastructure is really important. In fact, you know, I'd say for CISOs, like, what percentage of your web applications do you have any visibility on? That's a real question and a real problem. If you can't actually see where attacks are happening, then how do you know you're being effective at preventing them in the first place?
Right. Yeah, and of course, going back and rewriting on those legacy applications is not an easy task.
No, it's exactly right. But, you know, if you're doing new projects or you're moving to the cloud, you have some more choices.
Yep.
In sort of embedding, you know, security up front. And that's where, you know, I think you can probably make the most impact. You make a lot larger impact if you're involved in the process. So, yes, everyone's going to have a huge legacy overhang. But if you're doing a new project, thinking about how do you really instrument the code and get feedback to developers as fast as possible in the pre-release cycle. And then, you know, there's lots of choices in how to sort of get instrumentation for the real-time portion as well. But getting those sort of nailed up front and early, you can make a huge difference and really change the game and sort of the security posture of the application.
Right. Does gaining telemetry on your legacy applications, does that help migrate them from legacy into something new? Like, does it aid that process by having those insights and seeing how it's running and looking at things like security and performance? Sure. So right?
It still is going to be a legacy application. I mean, the problem with like instrument code is you assume there's an engineering team even working on it, or that's the true. Code's in source repository, or it's on a non-obsolete platform. Like, these are things like I see almost on a daily basis with some of our customers. It's just like, well, we need protection, but there's actually no engineers on it. So how do you do that? But the thing that's important for security is, you know, you think you know what your risks are, but until you see it, you don't know. So the example that comes to mind is, the public example that comes to mind would be the Zappos breach, which was, you know, I'm sure they poured tons of money in their front-facing app and whatnot, but the breach was actually do through a customer service portal. And so if you can't protect what you don't know.
Right, exactly.
That's why gain visibility is super important. It still is going to make that application run on whatever junk it's running on, and that's the life you live in. But at least you should know if people are looking at it. And we see this all the time. You know, we're doing sales or something like that. They install us, and they'll call us back and like, hey, did you launch an attack against us, or what's going on here? I'm just like, what do you mean? It's like, well, we have this test system and we haven't advertised it. We're getting all this traffic from name your favorite foreign country that's no business looking at it. Like, how did they find it? It's just like, welcome to the internet, man. Like, right. that's how it works.
You're only a few milliseconds away from every attacker in the world, right?
That's right. I think my co-founder Zane said this. I'm not sure if he made it up or not, but it's like, you know, you're on the internet, you get a free pen test, you just might not get the report.
Right.
Like someone's poking you. But you might not know that unless you actually get some instrumentation happening, you know, across all your infrastructure.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think many have kind of lost sight of that over the years too. I think it was, you know, 10 plus years ago, much harder to identify everything on the public internet. And now, I mean, there's companies that's like what they do, right? And you're naive to think that attackers haven't adopted that same technology to just continually map the internet. So even if you're not indexing with a search engine or whatever, if you're on the internet, someone is going to find it, and much more quickly than they could before.
Oh yeah, there's in the last couple of years, being able to scan the entire IPv4 address space is actually doable and fairly simple if you know where to look. So there are people constantly exploring everything that's available. And so the thing with like knowing like where attackers looking at, where are they poking, that's just to help prioritize your sort of precious time and trying to figure out what needs to get hit. Everyone thinks it's their payment gateway, but it turns out those are actually pretty good and pretty solid. It's the customer service portal based on some CMS from who knows what on who knows what platform is where you're going to get owned.
Right. For sure.
Yeah. So we know, I mean, we've been talking about this long enough that we know that integration of security into DevOps. But I think the challenge that a lot of people have, including the CISOs, is where do they start? How do they start the dialogue? How do they break down maybe some of the communication barriers? Because development's a different team. It may be a peer group. It may not be a peer group. How should organizations start to tackle just the communication aspects of what should we be doing as an organization?
Great question. And every organization is certainly come up with different answers or solution to it. But the very first step is, for CISOs or even security people, this is what I would do. Let's say it's my day one, I'm CISO somewhere, is I'd be setting up one-on-ones with the VP engineering or CIO as frequently as they'll let me do. And I'd certainly set up a whole bunch of sort of lunch and learns and whatever, just to try and lure some engineers in. The more you can sort of engage engineers and sort of what your pain points are, absolutely the better. And it turns out engineers are actually really interested in security. They're just not necessarily incentivized as part of their job to worry about it like security professionals are, obviously. So first up is this sort of creating informal communication patterns. And then you can start sort of working up the dialogue of like, well, how should we go about doing this? Because you can't do it on your own. You're not the ones creating the bugs, right? In AppSec, it's other people, right? So you have to sort of figure out how to bridge that gap. And that's where, trying to get static analysis and scanners in is really challenging because that does slow down development. That does slow down the check-in process, or it certainly can if you're sort of done naively. So that is a real challenge, but like starting the dialogue and how to do it, thinking this is very challenging for CISOs to do, especially in this job market, but actually hiring engineering staff, actual engineers, not just security people in your team, makes a huge difference because you're not draining resources from engineering, or at least that's not the perception anymore. So you're able to actually work on projects yourself independently from the engineering team to improve security. Those are just a couple ideas to get started. And then certainly, working with operations, you can get some instrumentation on the real-time application. Once engineers start seeing, not just engineers, CISOs, VP engineers, CEOs, once they start seeing security is not this black and white thing, but like attacks are happening all the time, constantly, they have a much healthier respect for what you do in AppSec than they would have otherwise. Otherwise, it's just sort of invisible, and invisible things typically aren't valued very much.
Right. So bringing that visibility in that, look, your applications are constantly under attack. We all want to do a better job for the company. So by giving that visibility, maybe it helps produce better code, more secure code on the other side, because they have that visibility that they didn't have before.
Even more than that, many people have gone through, whatever compliance required security training is, and it's like, oh yeah, parameterize your SQL queries or, whatever they say. But if you ask most engineers, well, have you actually seen an actual SQLi attack, like probing your site for something? Like 99.9% of the time, they'll say like, no. Once they see someone scanning their own application and own code, it pretty much radically changes the conversation. It's not an abstract thing anymore. There's an adversary. It really changes the dialogue quite a bit, makes them much more receptive to security training, security dialogue, and just sort of understanding the problem space that CISOs are trying to solve.
Yeah, agreed. So that's great. That's some ideas across. That's kind of that lateral peer-to-peer kind of move. But now, if I'm the CISO, what are those things I should be tracking and communicating upwards? Because I think that's the other challenge, is we think, you know, traditionally in a network environment, we know vulnerabilities and we know incidents. But on the AppSec side, what are the right kind of metrics and communications upward to the rest of the executives or the board? Where should they be focused on that front?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, really challenging. And hopefully you have a boss that's actually interested in security in the first place, which is, goes a long way. But the first step is sort of, one thing I really like is what percent of your systems you have any understanding of? Because that's a number. And my guess is the number's going to be pretty bad. But that's actually a good place to start, because then you can actually practice. There's a couple things that are great about it. One, if there's a problem, it's already expected. If you say, like, I got coverage on 13% of my applications, doesn't even say that it's good coverage. You have something on 13% of your applications. And breach happens, kind of expected then, right? Like, you know, you have a huge portion of your site not protected. Nice thing also about a number is you can actually show progress in things. And it certainly shows, here's the favorite game. Like, hey, so if I'm going to spend $100,000, I think I can move the 13% to 20%. Like, okay, any good CEO or CTO or, you know, venture partner is going to say, like, cool, what if we spent $200,000? What would I get for my bang for the buck then? And you can really have a really interesting dialogue on risk reward, on the type of instrumentation you're putting in place, the type of processes you're putting in place. But just having a really honest conversation of, like, what do you know now? And then you can sort of really move forward. I think it really will be very eye-opening for everyone involved.
Yeah, agreed. Because I think that's a challenge, right? First, to your point, visibility. But then even just what are those base metrics? I mean, percent coverage, great.
Right.
I'm sure there's other.
If you don't even have instrumentation, that's fine too. How many of your applications have had any static analysis done on them ever? Okay, it's probably not a great number, but that's okay. That gives you a starting point to know how hard your job is to your boss, right? And that's actually what you want to communicate. You don't want them to find out when there's a breach that all this stuff isn't covered. You really want to sort of socialize that, going back to the beginning of the show. And you really want to socialize that type of information way up front.
Yeah, it's interesting when we talk about metrics, you know, in this light, because I think you have a tendency to use, like, most frequently or least frequently. And so you might use the metric of, well, how many tickets do we have open, right? When really mm-hmm. the metric is, are we fixing the things that really matter, right? Security or otherwise. And how do you right. how do you measure that?
Right. Or how many applications have there's even a place to put a ticket.
Yeah.
I can just assure you, like, in a large enterprise, you know, there are literally thousands of applications of every possible ilk imaginable. Mm-hmm. And do we see stuff on Windows 32 and Red Hat CentOS 5, which are completely obsolete? Like, we see that all the time. You know, so, like, there's a how much of the stuff you're protecting is in, like, a really bad shape or, you know, doing well, and being able to sort of qualify or quantify those metrics in a way, I think, you know, laterally and upwardly, they'll appreciate that sort of thoughtfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other big challenge is open source. How much open source am I using? What version of open source? I mean, obviously, we've had some major vulnerabilities in open source. But again, that's a visibility problem.
Yep.
But that's kind of embedded even a layer deeper down into the app, because what libraries and binaries am I using?
Okay, yeah, but here's the way of translating that. How many of our applications are at patch level? You know, it's like, it's really that simple. Like, is the OS at patch level? Is the application at patch level? Is the open source components at the appropriate level of, you know, are they being patched at all? So it's like, yeah, there's lots of open source stuff playing around, but how much of it is even up to date or current or, you know, by patch level, I mean, you don't necessarily need to use the latest version, but you need to use the latest sort of minor version that's appropriate for your code base. Just even having like basic answers of are you up to date or not is actually a really great way of getting started in information.
Yeah, I agree, Nick. I mean, there's a lot of nuances to that. And we, you know, sit here as pundits and we talk about all the various, you know, nuances of what code are you incorporating as open source and how do you know if it's patched or not. But to your point, at a basic level, you got to know that like your operating system, your application server, and the libraries that you can easily identify whether they're patched or not, as in the Equifax case, pretty straightforward that there was, you know, an open source component that was vulnerable. I mean, that's just, if you start there as your baseline, I think you're going to see a significant improvement in the security of your code, and it's going to allow you to build upon that.
Yeah, and you know, it's like some of these things, like, you know, for certainly for library updates and open source updates, you know, I'd be surprised if the security team is actually responsible for doing that. They are maybe responsible for calling out the problem. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, that's another great dialogue. If you're reporting metrics, not to cast shade on your engineering, you know, family, but just facts, right? What's up to date, what's not up to date, and how fast are they getting up to date? Those are great metrics like anyone can start with. Yep. Just to have a dialogue, not to actually cast blame, because engineers are underwater doing whatever they're doing already. Absolutely. But it's a great way of actually having a dialogue to say, like, how can we make things better? How can we improve a process there so we can update stuff?
Yeah, and have a plan. I mean, the open source example is one that I've, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about with various people. And once you have the ability to collect the telemetry, then you can say, well, you know, we've been using this open source library for 3 years and it's never been updated, but there's never been a published security advisory. At least you can go collect those things and every once in a while manually look at them and then have a process in place to say, did it get abandoned? Do we need to take over this project? Sure. Those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And those are great numbers to report and have dialogues with engineering, because it's a risk for them too, just in terms of operational support and, you know, performance and, you know, just because there's no security problem doesn't mean there's not an operational problem. So there's, you know, it's a good dialogue to have with engineering on exactly those types of things.
Yeah. And I mean, as we know, oftentimes getting ahead of the problem and being proactive in fixing it before bad things happen, you know, is a conversation I have actually with my wife about household things, right? Because if similar to a household, right, you let things go, you know, your dishwasher or whatever appliance is, you know, beyond its life and you're limping along, you got to do some proactive maintenance and have a plan to replace it. I feel like the software building blocks, it's a similar kind of thing. Identifying things early, fixing them before they become problems, not just in software, but in IT in your household is a very similar process.
Yeah, it's and easier said than done, as you probably know in your household, right?
Right. And the priority of things, it's a business decision, just like in your software, right?
Right.
My house, there's three kids. So things like the washer and the dryer and the dishwasher are pretty mission critical when you have, you know, that five people to process all their laundry and dishes, right? It's the same thing with software. What's most critical to the business and what do we know we definitely have to be proactive or it's really going to hurt, right?
Right. And then the trick is, how do you bundle up all these things we just talked about in a way so the CEO or the board or, you know, CTO, depending on who you report to, can actually understand and help you and help the organization solve?
Absolutely.
That might be the hardest part of all, right?
Yeah, it's understanding the risk behind the technical debt that you're incurring, I think, is likely like the way to summarize it for if you've got software projects that you're trying to manage, right?
Yeah, but the nice thing is if you do this right, you can report every quarter if you're making a difference or not. Mm-hmm. If you're not making a difference, well, then you probably are like have a resourcing problem, which is a great dialogue to have with your boss on your budget, right? So getting these numbers up front and reporting them regularly, while may or may not, you know, solve all your problems, is a good way of really sort of getting a dialogue with, you know, laterally and upward on just sort of how to make improvements and how to actually protect things. Mm-hmm. And certainly it gives you a seat at the table when a new project is going on, because they're already familiar with you. They know the issues. Mm-hmm. They know who you are, you know, all this type of stuff.
Yeah. Are there, you know, I think a lot of people still struggling with this a little bit. You know, I think this whole DevOps digital transformation is new to a lot of security folks. Any good resources that CISOs and other people in security could go find to help them kind of do a better job of integrating with the DevOps teams?
Security integrated better with the DevOps teams?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple things, and that is, so you do have a DevOps team, or there's some pipeline, or you have some, a release cycle. I mean, like, hey, when I was doing this 5 years ago, if you were able to deploy on demand, that was a big deal, as opposed to going through like a QA process for 3 weeks and then having another process to release the code. If you have like something where you're able to actually release code on demand as needed, which I think most DevOps pipelines do, maybe it's homegrown, maybe it's through Jenkins, maybe through Travis CI, maybe it's through AWS and Google Azure. They all provide some type of code building and release pipeline stuff. That's where you can sort of get in and insert your static analysis tools. Even my advice on that is do the dumbest, lightest, cheapest thing possible, because my guess is that is going to turn up stuff. You don't need the most sophisticated stuff to get started. You just need to get in line, and then you're going to start seeing stuff. And from there, you can expand outward. But step one is just whatever the dumbest static analysis check is you can possibly think of. If it's using grep to find problems in code, stick that in the build pipeline so you can spot things right away. You want to know about unused crypto? Great. Go grep for MD5 in your code base, every release. If someone pushes out some busted crypto, you're going to find it. You're getting an alert on it, and you're going to be able to sort of remediate it and find it faster that way. So that'd be my first step, is just get in the build release pipeline.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest challenge is where do they start?
Right? I think the first step is like, well, go find out. One is get that dialogue with the DevOps people and let them know who you are. And you can do some lunch and learns, or go to their lunch and learns, actually. And then figure out like, hey, so everyone's got different problems. I don't know what language it is, but if you can make a check that's grepable, you can just scan source code in the dumbest way possible. And just then have a dialogue like, how can I get this check in so I know, not blocking the release, just so you know something is happening. I think that's a pretty reasonable first step. Because your first check will have lots of false positives or not, or it might have an enormous amount of work, or it might have none. But if you're just saying like, hey, I just need to know what's going on, I'm not going to block the release, not yet anyway. That's a pretty reasonable request to ask, for anyone who's working on the build pipeline. But the first step one is getting that dialogue going. If you don't have the dialogue, nothing's happening.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest one for security to have right now.
To get started, like, you should go out to lunch. You should go find out what their problems are. It's a two-way street, right? Like, they have their own issues of stuff they're battling and working on. And, the perspective from the outside, like, everything's just wonderful and perfect in DevOps land. It's not. They're just people, too, with limited resources trying to get stuff done for the business as well. So go have lunch. Go find out what they're working on. Go find out how they might be able to help you, or more importantly, how the stuff they're building you can leverage yourself.
Yeah, that's good. Paul, any more questions for Nick while we have him?
No, good. That was an awesome discussion. Loved it.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Okay, well, next time we'll do a Friendster tell all. No,
that's right. Come on, PSW for that, right?
Right on. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. If anyone wants to learn more about Signal Sciences, please visit securityweekly.com/signalsciences. We'll take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
The modern attack surface is vast and permeable, extending from the data center to the cloud and device edge. Security teams are stretched thinner and thinner as they try to cover this ground. The result? More high-profile breaches hit the news every day. Don't let your organization be next. ExtraHop delivers security from the inside out, helping enterprise security teams detect threats up to 95% faster and cut staff time to resolve by 2/3 or more. Act with confidence. Learn more at extrahop.com/securityweekly. Major data security breaches continue to make headlines. Are you prepared? Standardizing your security framework will help you stay competitive, be a reliable business partner, and manage intellectual property, financials, and employee and customer information. The American National Standards Institute, or ANSI, offers the standards you need in one place through standard subscriptions, a cost-saving, fully customizable solution. Sign up for your free trial at securityweekly.com/ANSI. Let the team at Black Hills Information Security test your defenses. With over 10 years of experience in penetration testing, red teaming, and threat hunting, the testers at Black Hills will help you find the holes in your security before the bad guys do. The team at Black Hills cares about educating and sharing their knowledge by creating countless blogs, open source tools, and webcasts for you to learn more about the tradecraft of pen testing and red teaming. Visit securityweekly.com/BHIS to join their mailing list and view the latest blogs and webcasts from Black Hills Information Security.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian. Secure World Boston is hosting their 15th annual conference next week, March 27th and 28th, at the Hines Convention Center. Security Weekly listeners save $100 off a full conference pass by visiting secureworldexpo.com and using the discount code SecurityWeekly. Also, we just released our 2019 Security Weekly 25 Index Survey. Please go to securityweekly.com and click the survey link to help us understand who's evaluating, using, or formally use any of the Security Weekly 25 companies. The results will be summarized and presented back to all responders in a private webcast. Yeah, we'll keep that survey open another week or two, try to get some more results, because I'm curious how people are using some of these public security companies.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun to kind of analyze that data. All right, let's dig into our articles for this week. You know me, I try to piece all these together, so we'll see how these go. First article for me is why you need to avoid distractions when you write. This is a big one for me. I think it's more than just writing sometimes for me, but this is one area where I can't have noise or distractions around me. Writing, especially things like blog posts or presentations, right? We've been working on our marketing presentation that we're going to give at InfoSec World. I need to isolate myself and get those distractions away. Other tasks are okay, but I for some reason, I really have to concentrate when I'm building presentations or writing. The great article that talks about some of those distractions and how to eliminate them.
I think it's how it fueled one of my passions for headphones and such, because whenever I write an article or write code, like I distractions are really hard, right? And I think it's pretty similar in that when you're writing a presentation, an article, or code, if you get interrupted, even if it's a mental disruption, like you see a pop-up alert come up that someone's texting you, or there's background conversation and now you're half paying attention to what's going on in the background, and you lose your flow, right? And so it's almost like you're taking a mental break from what you're doing, and then you have to go back to it. And when you do that, your brain has to like reassimilate that information to get back where you were. So it takes like three times as long. Not even twice as long, three times as long.
Yeah, yeah. And he talks about the three, right? People, mm-hmm. right? Close the door to my office. Mm-hmm. Okay, out. Phone. Phone's a big one for a lot of people, mm-hmm. right? We're so used to, you know, a notification pops up on your phone. You're like, oh, I got to look at it.
Right.
And then just the internet in general. And the internet's the easiest one for me, actually, because I don't really do a lot of surfing. I don't have a lot of social media. I'm pretty boring that way. It's my Twitter for work. It's my LinkedIn for work. But, you know, I'm not doing Facebook or anything like that. So that one's actually really easy for me. But it's the phone, and because I work at home, the people.
Yeah,
that's the hardest too for me.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah. I guess it kind of ties into afraid to take a break.
Yes, it does. See, I try to pull these mm-hmm. together, right? Because you just said it, right? You just said it's like taking a break. This article actually talks about the good of forcing yourself to take a break. Now, in the previous article, those distractions sometimes can give you a break, but an unintended break. This article really digs into why taking breaks at periodic times is really good for you to kind of recharge, maybe for creativity and other things.
Oh yeah.
Which is needed at times.
Yeah, you got to come back to it. So I think you know the first article addressed the flow that you have, right? But whatever you're creating, whether it be an article, a presentation, or software, you oftentimes will get to a point where you're kind of stuck, right? You may see in your article, like, I kind of know what I want to describe, but I don't know the best way to describe it, right? Or in my presentation, like, I know I need some slides to talk about this, but like, just not there yet. In code, all the time, I'm like, I'm stuck. Like, I don't know how to solve this technical problem, and I've tried 3 or 4 different things. Those are the points where I think it's important that you take a break, step away. It goes back to my good buddy Dave when I first started working in IT. Dave was the troubleshooting man. He was the manager of our customer support department. And the greatest lesson Dave taught me was walk away. He's like, let's go outside, have a smoke, or, you know, get a cup of coffee. We'll talk about it, but step away. And oftentimes you come back and either you've got those creative juices flowing again, or you're like, oh, I got like 3 things to try now that I'm really excited about that I just couldn't pull myself out of the weeds enough to see the forest through the trees until I took a break. Yeah, super important.
Yeah, and I do the same thing with presentations. Mm-hmm. I'm doing the InfoSec World DevSecOps Summit, and I have a kind of a standard presentation, but I draft it.
Yes.
And then I don't touch it for days. Then I go back and I review it. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I want to add this. I want to tweak that. I did the same thing with our marketing presentation last week. I drafted it, sent it to you guys to review, didn't look at it for a couple days, knowing I wanted to add some more stuff, but then I went back to it and then I kind of added those additional pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good way for me to get the initial thoughts on paper, then kind of review it and finalize that. But sometimes that couple day break in the middle, in the case of my InfoSec World presentation, it was a couple weeks.
Yep.
It really gives me an opportunity to go back and fine tune it and really get across that message I want to get across.
Yeah, it's why it's important to build in time to do that kind of stuff, right? Some people can write the whole presentation the night before. I can't do that. I at least have to have a draft that I'm working off of. And then sure, the night before I'm putting in my final edits, or the day before night before the deadline or whatever. Although most of the time I don't really meet the deadline, but that's neither here nor there. At the final hour, I'm revising it, right? And that's important.
Correct. And I always have to do that final prep right before I present it anyways.
Yeah, absolutely.
And irregardless, there's always like, oh yeah, I want this animation to look a different, or I tweak a word or something. The final is never final for me, unfortunately, I think in some cases.
Yeah. Oh, so Boeing's 737. I saw some news articles about this, Matt.
Yeah, just a few. I thought this was a really good article because it talks about how Boeing should have responded to this crisis. And look, most of our listeners are going to remember the Tylenol scare from years ago, right? And Johnson & Johnson at the time said, look, we're going to pull everything off the shelves. We're going to redo all this stuff. They took it very seriously. And created really the standard of how most people would respond to some sort of life-threatening activity. And this article goes in to say, you know, Boeing really didn't do that with the 737 MAX, right? We had the Ethiopia Air a week or so ago, and then 5 months before that was another crash. And so a lot of people are questioning, is the plane safe? And instead of stepping back, which this article talks about, and saying Boeing should have said, look, we believe in our stuff, but yeah, you're right. Maybe we should temporarily ground these aircraft, take a deep dive, investigate. Let's make sure everything's working okay, because we see this is a potential crisis. And then, you know, get the actual research done and then come back out and decide which way to go. They took a stance, we're safe. We're fine. There's nothing wrong here. And I think it's important for any company where there's a potential concern of life, and in this case there was, to kind of take the high ground a little bit and say, look, we're going to voluntarily do this because, look, we believe in our stuff, but we get it. There might be a consumer concern or you know, in the case of a different aviation administration saying, you know, let's make sure the safety of our passengers are first. this article talks about maybe they should have gone that route and maybe it wouldn't have been so bad because their stock has taken a beating mm-hmm. in the last week over these just continual stories about the concerns of this plane.
Yeah, and it's not always, you don't always have a smoking gun when there's an issue, right? And
right.
planes aside, in IT especially, it takes time to dig down into, oh, I can now prove that that's the issue, right? And what you don't want to do is start swapping out a bunch of components, whatever, hardware or software, without knowing exactly if that's going to fix the problem or not. Because then you're just swapping stuff out for the sake of swapping stuff out, right? So I think it's really important to understand the problem, how it presents itself, understand what caused the problem, and then test your fix to make sure that it's fixed, and now you're ready to move forward. But doing those things is not straightforward with something as complex as an airplane or some kind of server or whatever, right?
Right. And I think this is just a really good lesson for leaders when there is a major crisis. Step back, decide your actions so that you're looking at it from the customer or the consumer mm-hmm. point of view and understand that realm in order to, you know, make the right decisions about how you move forward. It's just a really good lesson here that I thought would really resonate with some of the leaders that have to make some of these hard calls and decisions when something goes wrong. It's just something that I would ask them to kind of reflect on and say, yeah, maybe Boeing could have handled it better. Maybe I can learn from that. So the next time something happens, maybe I respond differently.
Well, and I think it, going back to our conversation with Nick from Signal Sciences, it's why having that telemetry is so important. And I think when it's a security incident, sometimes we can't answer some of the questions that are being asked because we don't have the right telemetry or information. We're like, I don't know. And that's the worst answer you could have as an executive that is responding to a security breach and you got to go in front of your board. And they're like, how did they get in or what happened? You're like, I don't know, right? You've got to be able to collect that information accurately and respond to it according to your plans. And for me, it's about being resilient, I think is the best word that I can think of. It's not being completely foolproof or bulletproof, right? But it's about being resilient. Part of that is understanding your failures, why it failed, and having a corrective action plan moving forward.
Yeah. The other piece here, which ties into this next podcast, is it's also building trust with your customers and your consumers,
yes,
which is important from a brand perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to dig into this. I'm a big believer in open, transparent trust relationships. I always have been. I've said in my career, you're going to love me or you're going to hate me, but you're always going to get it straight from me. That's just the way I am. But taking that and building trust, I think, is important. This podcast that's on HBR, I think, is a really good one to listen to mm-hmm. on reinforcing how do you build that trust internally, externally. It's just it's a component, and it's something that's so important to the security community. You know, we have to build trust with the development teams, like we talked about in the last session with Nick. We have to build trust with the board and others that we're doing the right things to mitigate risk. We have to build trust with our customers that we're securing their data, protecting their privacy. Trust is an important part, I think, of the security ecosystem and all of us in it. And so this is a really good podcast for people to, you know, get some tips on how to build that trust. I won't dig into it much more than that. Mm. Kind of tied into the last article.
Cool.
All right, let's get into a couple other things here that I thought were interesting. Digital transformation is not about technology. This is a good article. And, you know, a lot of us think about the technology aspects of digital transformation. We think about applications and containers and cloud and all this stuff. There's a lot more to digital transformation than technology. I'm going to give you a perfect example. I only trust online banks. I don't trust any of the mobile banking apps. And my main bank decided they were going to swap out the online banking system, a technology decision. I hate the new app, the online interface. It's horrible. And this article talks about why it's not just a technology decision. It's get input from your customers. You know, think about what's strategic Think about how that impacts usage and user experience. Those are big drivers for digital transformation, not the technology component, because I can't stand using the new online app. Technology-wise, it might have been better for them, but from a user perspective and how I use the app, oh, I can't stand it. It's silly things like, I can't tell between my credit cards because they're both Chase cards, mm-hmm. but I don't know which one's my Visa and which one's my MasterCard because the way it's displayed. If I want to log out, I have to log out but also forget my device, right? There's a way to remember your device so you don't have to do the two-factor.
Right.
But the only way to remember the two-factor is for you not to officially log out. Well, who the heck doesn't log out of their online application? It's just ridiculous. It's stuff like that that just drives me crazy from a user experience, all in the name of digital transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, and I when I read the headline, I really thought about it, and I was like, you know, it really is more about a user experience and how people interact with technology more so than the technology itself. Because to be quite frank, I mean, a lot of the technology isn't really truly innovative, right? But the way that it's become more mainstream and the way humans interact with it is part of that evolution that we were dubbing digital transformation, right? But it's more about the human interaction with the technology.
Yeah, it's making our products and services more accessible to the users and the consumers of it in a very efficient way. And if user experience is not part of that design criteria, it doesn't matter what technology you're going to use, it's going to fail miserably.
Right.
And that's the point of this article. Government takes baby steps in data privacy with NIST framework and build discussions. Obviously, GDPR kind of put privacy on the map, and there's been a lot of conversations about how this is going to roll out in the U.S. California passed a privacy regulation. We are starting to see some traction more centrally. I think the big fear with data privacy will be, do we have 50 different laws for 50 different states, which means it's really going to be hard to implement for various companies, or will the federal government come in and provide some direction? So NIST has been tagged with developing a privacy framework that looks like it's the first iteration is going to come out later this year around October. They've already done an initial request for information. They're soliciting feedback. I think there's a draft review in May with some sort of framework coming out in October, which would kind of look like the NIST cybersecurity framework, but from a privacy perspective, which is good. It would at least give us kind of an ideal framework of how to implement privacy in a consistent way. The next question then is, will Congress do something with that and pick up and kind of standardize it across the U.S. as one bill, or will we end up with 50 different legislations?
Right.
Looks like we're making a little progress on that front. So just something to track. I mean, obviously anybody in a senior role, you know, these are going to be some interesting areas to watch over the next few months this year as they get into the draft and then maybe into this final framework.
It's always interesting how you have to deal with regulations and all that stuff on a national level, but also on a state-by-state basis.
Yeah.
It makes it very complicated.
It's very complicated. We went through this with the breach laws years ago. California did the first breach notification law, and then we ended up with 49 other variations across the country, which makes anybody who's in the breach notification business knows that depending on the breach and where your customers are and which state they're in, the requirements are different. That's super hard to manage. If we had one breach notification law, it would be easy. Everybody could comply because it would be one standard way to do it, but that doesn't exist. And people fear the same thing on the privacy side, is it will end up with 50 variations of implementation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gartner's top 10 security projects for 2019. So we'll spend a little bit of time on this one, Paul, because there's some interesting projects in here. Number one on the list is privileged access management. That's just a little interesting. You know, we've been talking about privileged access for a while. I don't know the ranking order. I don't know if this is in priority order, but we're still seeing a lot on privileged access. and the need to implement additional controls for accounts that have admin access. Number two on my list, or Gartner's list, is continuous adaptive risk and trust assessment inspired vulnerability management.
What is that?
So let me what does that mean? I think this is more of a risk-based prioritization of vulnerability management. Again,
we've been wanting for a long time.
Long time. We talked about this in a session about a month ago. We talked about TVM, threat vulnerability management, and the need for a risk-based or prioritized approach to this, because having 10,000 open vulnerabilities by itself, we all know we can't close all those vulnerabilities. So which ones are the most important? That's what this means, is let's understand the risk associated with these vulnerabilities and then come up with a prioritized approach to actually solve and remediate these vulnerabilities.
Right.
Number three, detection and response, still high on the list. We've seen a lot in endpoint detection and response, updates to the Security Operations Center from a detection response perspective. That's number three on the list. A newer one, cloud security posture management. We had Cloud Needy on last week on Enterprise Security Weekly, kind of touching on this space, which is understanding the configuration, the security of your cloud environments. So this is number four on the list.
And they separate that from a CASB, a cloud access security broker, which is interesting.
Yeah, so CSPM is understanding the configuration of your cloud account and the configuration of the workloads that are in those cloud accounts. So right. Think of that more as
knowing infrastructure. What you have, and then CASB is about who should have access to what.
Exactly. So the number five is CASB, which talks about access to those cloud environments, and then how do you secure that access and the interaction with those assets. So those are four and five together, which make a lot of sense.
For sure.
Number six, business email compromise, still high on the list. Mm-hmm. We've been doing email forever. We talked about Armor. We talked to Armor Blocks a few weeks back, right before RSA, on business email compromise and some of the new techniques being used, leveraging natural language processing, for example, to do a better job of addressing this problem. Dark data discoveries, number seven. Which is interesting, right? I think it ties into GDPR and what data of yours is sitting out on the dark web, and you know, how do you get it back or protect it or whatever. Security incident response is number eight, still high on the list. The SOC processes are not going away anytime soon, so secure incident response. Number nine is container security, near and dear to my heart. I was surprised it was this kind of down here at nine. As we see more and more application development, I see this as a big challenge for organizations, understanding how to secure these new containerized environments, the new app, the APIs. This is a big space. I expect this to continue to go up the list over time. Mm-hmm. And then number 10 was security rating services. This is the external digital risk assessments with people like BitSight and Risk Recon, Security Scorecard, understanding where all these, based on your relationship with companies, how are their external assets, how well do they score and rate. This drives into some third-party vendor management potential concerns and issues. So that's number 10. So that's Gartner's top 10 for this year.
Interesting.
Yeah, a lot of interesting projects.
I think it needed our commentary, Matt. If I were to just read this, right, I might be like, what do you think they mean by that, right? I think it was a good discussion to kind of dig into how you think of each of these areas, right, and what we think Gartner really means by it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, two paragraphs on some of these, not enough to really understand the context.
Agreed.
And then my last article for this week is, with cloud basics covered, organizations embrace the disruption of open source. Again, we talked a little bit about open source on the last segment. And I think this is a an emerging area of concern in the application security space. We see a big move to open source under the DevOps movement. And open source is one area where I think there's still a lot of concerns and issues. And how do you manage and embrace it? You know, we saw, for example, at Layered Insight, just the PHP library just continue to grow and grow and grow in vulnerabilities. Really nobody closing them, nobody solving them. And we're embedding these libraries and binaries into our main applications, which are going to create new attack vectors under these new apps. So I think this whole issue of open source is a big area that I think a lot of people need to get their arms around and kind of figure out how best do I manage inventory of my open source, analyzing that open source for vulnerabilities, how do I patch it, how do those new versions impact my application going forward? These are all big areas, I think, of concern.
Agreed. Sorry, I was just sipping my coffee.
Oh, slowly. It was either that or you're smoking your cigar.
That too, while you were talking. I think it's interesting how they drew the correlation between cloud and open source, which is interesting. I think open source is in a different light in the enterprise today, as is evidenced by whole new categories being created in these areas. But I think you're right, in the article's correct, in that as you're pushing applications to the cloud, your applications are more nimble. It's really just the application, and you're likely using some type of open source component in the development, in the CI/CD pipeline, in your deployment strategy, right? And so that becomes more and more of an issue today.
Yeah, you're also seeing very large vendors really embracing open source. Microsoft has been a big component of embracing more open source and building trust with the open source community. You saw the acquisition of Red Hat by IBM, bringing open source components into the IBM portfolio. So, I mean, you're seeing some major companies also see the same trend and embracing open source differently than they ever have. Because, well, let's go back 10 years. Microsoft, open source, IBM, open source. Those conversations weren't happening back then. But it's this move to the open source as part of some of this transformation that we're going through. Now you're seeing big corporate vendors now supporting and embracing open source like Microsoft and IBM. And I think that's also just going to help continue to fuel more adoption of this open source technology. But there, again, I think there's some gaps in the way we secure it and manage it that still have to be addressed.
Right. Agreed.
All right. Cool. That's all I had for this week, Paul.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.